zero deaths yesterday, zero deaths today. First time since we've sort of had a lot of cases that we've had zero deaths. You know, it does provide, obviously, a lot of relief. You know, we're down to an average of 4 or 5 deaths a day. And that's a huge, huge decrease. And I know it brings a lot of hope and joy back into our families.
LA County Public Health Director Barbara Ferrer yesterday celebrating 2 days in a row of zero deaths here in LA from COVID-19. After a devastating winter surge, California is now a national success story. California has the lowest coronavirus case rate per capita in the nation right now, around 30 for every 100,000 people here, even as cases spike in Washington state and in Oregon. So how did California do it? We're going to talk about all this with Monica Gandhi, infectious disease expert at UC San Francisco. Welcome back.
Hi, thank you.
Well, what is California doing right?
You know, what happened in California to me is really clear, and it simulates what happened in the UK. We unfortunately had a really bad third surge during the winter that actually gave us some immunity, natural immunity. Then we put down vaccines and we put them down fast. And so we never got that fourth surge that other places had seen. The vaccines were coming out fast. And essentially between the combination of all this immunity, between our natural immunity and our vaccines going in, our cases are low. Luckily, like you just said, our deaths are low. LA County is the most populous county in the United States, and to have zero deaths from COVID-19 is simulating what's going on in Israel right now at a 62% first dose rate.
Wow. So that's really remarkable. When you say that we had vaccines on the ground fast, why were we faster or were we faster than other states?
We weren't actually faster at the beginning. So let's admit it. We all did stories on the rollout seemed to be not doing as well. And that actually was true of every state. And then there were a lot that got figured out. And that's a combination of mass vaccination sites, so big places like Dodger Stadium, also peripheral sites. So hub and spoke model, peripheral sites are pharmacies, are people where people go and get care. And then going into communities that are traditionally don't have a lot of equity in their healthcare, working hard on that, including in San Francisco, where we even have a higher first dose rate in Latinx communities. So I think we did a lot right in terms of vaccine rollout, but it was unfortunately also on top of our natural immunity that led to these low cases. So if you want to compare the UK and Israel, UK had a lot of natural immunity too, because they had really high rates of infection. Unfortunately, they vied with the United States in per capita. And when they laid out vaccines, they didn't see a surge. Israel had low natural immunity. They saw a surge and then they came down.
What is our natural immunity? Do we know?
Well, I think we do know. So there was a seroprevalence study that was done by the California DPH in February. And this was not when we were rolling out in the general population vaccine yet. It was in long-term care facilities, healthcare workers. So the general population didn't get it. We have about a 38% seroprevalence rate among Californians. And in places like LA, the rate was 45%. So a lot of people saw COVID over this terrible third surge, 29% in San Francisco, buried all over the region. And that report is publicly available.
Well, 45% in LA, so nearly half.
Yes, a lot of people saw the infection over our third surge. It was an unfortunate way to get to immunity. We, of course, wanted to get to it first with vaccines, but California had a very difficult third surge.
You mentioned Dodger Stadium and other mass vaccination sites as one reason for getting people vaccinated. That's scheduled to be closed toward the end of the month. Is it too soon to do that, given the fact that really, even with what we've just said, only around 32% of the county residents have been fully vaccinated?
You know, it's a great question. Today, President Biden gave a speech that said at a 70% first vaccination rate in those over 18, you can declare in your region the public emergency over. Because yesterday, Governor DeSantis in Florida declared the public emergency over. You know, we are actually at a very high first vaccination rate, above 18 in the state of California. In the entire country, it's 56.3%, so 14 percent points more to go. But because California has very low vaccine hesitancy, we're up closer to 64%, above 18. So we're getting very close to the to where President Biden said we don't have a public health emergency anymore. So as long as people are not in long lines, as long as people know where they can go for a vaccine, it's okay as our lines slow down to make it available elsewhere. I will say that for young people, it's often really helpful to just have it at your pharmacy or even at doctor's offices, which a lot of us providers are messaging, please give it to us in our doctor's offices.
Mm-hmm. So I guess when you talk about vaccine hesitancy versus availability in terms of getting people vaccinated, do you think that's the bigger hurdle, is the availability? Around 11% of California's population may be vaccine hesitant, according to the CDC.
You know, what I have seen with vaccine hesitancy is how amazingly unpredictive our surveys have been. More people have taken this vaccine than we thought. And that's because I think it's a way to get out of how abnormal life has been. And it's very positive to message that we're going to get out of this pandemic. So, for example, there was a New York Times article this morning that said, do what it takes. Tell people that masks and distancing are going to work. That led some Republicans. They said that masks and distancing will end. 18% more likely to get the vaccine. So message positively that life's going to go back to normal. That also going to communities that were traditionally vaccine hesitant in a community-based approach, and also telling people that, you know, just education really. California has done very well. I'm not even sure that 11% are going to be vaccine hesitant. And even if they are, we don't need to get to those high numbers. Again, what we look at with the Israel and the UK, which is why President Biden messaged this morning, we need to get to about a 70% rate. And we're getting that. We're very close. First dose.
There was also an article in the New York Times saying we might never get to herd immunity, that it probably wouldn't happen here or globally.
Yeah, I do actually disagree with that assessment. And there's been a couple of articles since, including in USA Today, that clarified that. I think it's better to use the word containment because everyone's getting tripped up on this word herd immunity. Herd immunity, the strict definition is that so many people are immune that the cases slow down on their own because the virus can't find anyone to infect. You're seeing that play out in California. You're seeing that play out in LA, in San Francisco, in Israel, in the UK. It is happening. That is actually how I learned it as an infectious disease doctor, the traditional, it doesn't mean eradication. It's very important. It doesn't mean eradication. It means this virus, the cases go down because the virus can't find people to infect. But I think now the word we're starting to use is containment. And I think we're getting to containment. Again, President Biden just told us that half an hour ago in a national speech.
All right. It's always great to speak with you. Thanks for coming on the show today.
Thank you.
That's Monica Gandhi, infectious disease expert at UCSF. Coming up, how to incentivize vaccine holdouts and the arguments for and against loosening patent restrictions. Those stories next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The Biden administration says it's now revising its vaccine strategy. The new goal will be to get 70% of Americans at least partially vaccinated by July 4th. This shift in strategy is an acknowledgement that the government needs to move away from the if you build it, they will come approach to convince people who might be hesitant to get their shots. Vaccine appointments have dipped nationally by about 30% from the peak in mid-April. Some cities, states, and businesses are now offering incentives to get more shots in the arms of the hesitant. And there's evidence from UCLA that this could work. Joining us to talk about vaccine incentives is Lynn Vavreck. She's professor of American politics and public policy at UCLA, where she's been studying vaccine incentives. Hi.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, what's behind this drop in vaccine appointments? It's happening everywhere.
Well, I think if you think about it sort of naturally, we're just entering a different phase of the vaccine rollout. And that first phase included a lot of people who were eager to get vaccinated to protect their own health, but also because they wanted to promote the public good. And we've worked through all of those eager folks. And now we're entering this different phase where we have a lot of people for whom maybe this is just less important to them. They don't think of this as a threat to their health. Some may be very hesitant, not really trust the government's motive. There are lots of reasons that people are not as eager as that first group, but that's the part of the rollout we're moving into.
Well, how many people are just not eager and just don't think about it versus are adamantly against?
Well, most people tell us, and we have interviewed thousands and thousands of people about the vaccine and their views, and most people tell us that they're concerned about side effects, they're concerned about whether it's safe. That's the bulk of people who are left. There are some people, about a quarter of the population, will also say, I don't trust the motives. But for a lot of people, it's really about, what is this doing to me?
So given that, what is the best way to counter that from a public health perspective?
Well, we ran some experiments where we randomly assigned this set of folks who have yet to be vaccinated to hear some different incentives that might that are, you know, governors around the country are trying, and lots of other organizations and public health organizations have tried. So we randomly exposed people to some of these incentives to see what would nudge people to become more likely to be vaccinated. And there are some things. One of the things that you mentioned earlier are material incentives. So we tested offering people cash, $25, $50, $100. That will increase people's vaccine uptake willingness. Other states are doing gift cards, or I think it is in New Jersey, you can get vaccinated and get a beer. So lots of states are playing around with these more material benefits. And that was one thing we tested that seemed to work.
So, yeah, I could see that. People would want some hard, cold cash in exchange. Why not?
Why not? The other thing we looked at was just sort of reminding people that if they do this, their life can go back to normal. And this is something that you were talking about just moments ago in the previous segment. If you get vaccinated, you can go out in public, not have to wear a mask, not have to social distance. And we asked people, would that make a difference compared to not telling people that, and compared to telling them that they would still have to do those things? And again, not surprisingly, just reminding people, or actually relaxing these requirements and then reminding people of that relaxation of the requirements, also increased people's willingness to go get vaccinated. Everyone's eager to get back to normal.
How does this break down along partisan lines? Because one study has shown that about 40% of people who voted for Donald Trump were vaccine hesitant or would not take the vaccination versus just 8% of people who voted for Joe Biden.
There's definitely a partisan component to this. And one of the things that I think will surprise people to hear is that those partisan differences that you just described are bigger in most cases than the kinds of things you might have led people, you might have thought led people to make decisions about vaccinations, like, for example, whether they're sick, if they have other diseases that make them more susceptible to COVID, how old they are, how educated they are. So the politicization of this virus that basically started a year ago really has affected how people in America are seeing the threat of COVID, how they're thinking about mitigating the spread, and how they're thinking about returning to normal activities.
Here's a clip of President Biden from his speech last week.
Everyone over the age of 16, everyone is now eligible to get vaccinated right now, right away. Go get vaccinated, America.
go and get the vaccination. They're available.
Is that an effective message?
Well, it depends on what you mean by the word effective. Does it convey important information? Yes, of course. Everyone over 16 is eligible. That's important information. But if effective, if what you mean is when he is instructing people, go get vaccinated, that, as with most things political, this will be a familiar trend to all your listeners. As with most political things, there is movement in the direction that it's intended among people who are in party to Joe Biden, so Democrats, but there's a backlash that happens among outpartisans. And we see that in messaging experiments we've run. And as you mentioned, there are other papers that are circulating where people have done this. And the backlash to the partisan messenger is large. And in some cases, it's bigger than the movement among the in-partisans, especially for Democrats. Right? Mm-hmm. You just mentioned Democrats are getting vaccinated. So there's less room to nudge people to vaccination among Democrats. They're already vaccinated. But when the president says that, he is leading a lot of Republicans to say, oh, I'm not going to go do it now.
And maybe he should stop doing that. Yeah. So what is the best way to get Republicans to take the vaccine, the ones who are hesitant?
Well, one of the biggest movers among Republicans of the stuff that we've tested is reminding people that the vaccine comes with a real change to their lives, like not having to wear masks in public, not having to social distance in public. That seems to move Republicans quite a bit. It is very hard to move anyone with just an endorsement. So, you know, your doctor, your pharmacist, your insurance company, the public health community, it's safe, it's effective, go get vaccinated. That doesn't seem to be moving people in this second phase, this resistant phase, as much as it was in the first phase when people were more eager.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. That's Lynn Vavreck, professor of American politics and public policy at UCLA. Well, as public health officials try to convince holdouts to get vaccinated, other countries are desperate to get enough vaccines to help curb a huge global surge, and they're begging the United States to help. That's why some in the public health community and even the Prime Minister of India want President Biden to waive patent restrictions on the coronavirus vaccines. This would, they say, ramp up production and lead to more people being vaccinated quicker. Others say that's really not the problem. The problem is more with production and distribution. The White House is reportedly debating what to do as Democrats on Biden's left flank pressure him to lift restrictions. Dan Diamond is national health reporter for The Washington Post, and he joins us now. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me back.
And Dan, this isn't just a decision for President Biden. This is a decision the World Trade Organization is taking on, right?
This current fight centers on a proposal that's at the World Trade Organization, which governs the use of intellectual property in all of its member nations, so about 160 countries around the globe. And the proposal would allow those countries, in theory, a lot more flexibility in taking the technologies, the know-how, and so on, from the pharmaceutical companies that have devised the coronavirus vaccines and rolling out generic versions. Now, where we are, Madeline, is that the United States has been opposed for about 7 months to this proposal even moving forward. They've stalled it. They've filibustered it in various ways at the World Trade Organization since last year. So what is expected to happen this coming week, as the United States heads back to the World Trade Organization, is some more debate and potentially some movement, just given all the pressure that you alluded to on the Biden administration from other Democrats.
So if the Biden administration basically says, no, we're against this, would the World Trade Organization then oppose it, or could they go ahead anyway?
Well, it's been interesting to watch over the number of months. India and South Africa introduced this proposal back in October. And more countries have joined them, including a number of countries that historically would side with the United States, countries like Costa Rica and Colombia. So the number of countries that are opposed has dwindled quite a bit. The United States is the most important of the countries that's left. The European Union, Britain have also tried to block this waiver from moving forward. But if President Biden said that he was in favor, then it's expected that other countries would probably fall in line, especially given the role of the United States in helping develop some of the vaccine technologies and the vaccines themselves.
Didn't he say he was in favor of lifting this on the campaign?
That's right. He was interviewed by Adi Barkin, who your listeners might know as the activist whose body has failed him over the past couple of years. He has ALS. And Adi, in quizzing candidate Biden, did get Biden to commit to sharing secrets of manufacturing the vaccines with the rest of the world, especially if the U.S. led the way. So that promise is now being brought to bear, and there are efforts to remind the White House of that pledge this week.
What are the arguments against it? I know the pharmaceutical companies are against it. What are they saying in opposition to this?
The pharmaceutical companies that are against this, on the one hand, are saying, look, we have the know-how, we have the expertise. That is limited. There are only so many people around the globe who even know how to make these vaccines. Every day that you're pulling them away from the production that's already underway, that will slow down the billions of doses that we're working on. If we have to provide briefings to other countries, that will be months behind in setting up their own factories, or maybe even years. I talked to the industry lobbying arm, Pharma, last week, and Pharma made the point that it can take 5 to 10 years sometimes to set up one of these new factories. So big pharmaceutical argument is, it is faster just to help us keep producing more vaccines rather than take what we have and try and teach others to do it. And there are arms of the administration, say the Commerce Department, that is very sensitive to that position. Also the argument that if we share these technologies that have huge potential even beyond coronavirus, the mRNA vaccines that appear to have potential in combating cancer or could have potential of doing harm if they're used wrongly, if they're in the wrong hands and could be used for some aspect of bioterror. There have been complaints that if we make that technology widely available with few constraints, it could come back to harm the U.S. in some global way. And then I think another argument, Madeline, is simply just where we are at this point in the pandemic. Pharmaceutical companies insist they don't have access to as many raw materials, ingredients that they need. And to have more companies around the world, new manufacturers, jumping in and trying to get those ingredients, that could just further choke efforts to produce vaccine.
But I guess my question is, why do these pharmaceutical companies have exclusive rights over the intellectual property over these vaccines if the federal government, in the case of the United States, spent billions of taxpayer dollars on these vaccines?
That's a great question. So you're alluding to, say, Operation Warp Speed, which helped rush the production of some vaccines, also made major investments in scaling up some production of supplies and securing doses for the United States. I think it's a complex question with a bunch of different ways to answer. One is that at the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic, lots of countries, not just the United States, were very concerned about where they fit in the global queue. Would they be prioritized for, say, vaccine doses? So they worked out contracts with these companies that helped ensure some exclusivity in some ways of getting doses as early as possible. And in return, the pharma companies had a fair amount of leeway of their own in terms of what they wanted to protect, what they were trying to guard. And in the case of the coronavirus vaccines, as we've seen from Pfizer, it's going to be billions and billions of dollars in revenue this year. So the pharmaceutical companies have leverage, and so do the governments that were putting in money. And that's in part why pharmaceutical companies still maintain significant protection over their creations.
What about pressuring these companies to just make a whole bunch more vaccine and sell them at cost or donate them to these countries that are suffering so much right now?
Well, that's part of what I think the White House would prefer. It gets out of the knotty issues around waiving intellectual property. It tees up the companies to voluntarily do what many would say is the right thing. And I think the challenge is what the pharmaceutical companies would say. They're trying to produce vaccine as fast as they can. They just need more raw materials and ingredients. That's where they want the U.S. and other global powers to focus, finding ways to create more capacity for them. I think the second issue, Madeline, is that the voluntary giving of doses, we might be dealing with coronavirus for years and years. It will probably be endemic as it circles the globe in different ways. So for countries that are hard hit to wait around for the charity of pharmaceutical companies, that makes it a lot harder to figure out how they're going to respond.
Dan Diamond, national health reporter for The Washington Post. Dan, thank you.
Madeline, thanks for having me on to discuss this very complex issue.
Well, we are in day one of KCRW's Drive to the Future. So this is our semi-annual fundraiser, and your support this time is going beyond public radio. So over the past year, you've heard our reporting on the people and communities impacted most by the pandemic. With this drive, you can make a difference, because during this time period, a portion of your donation to KCRW will also go to our community partners. And so you'll find out more about this throughout the day and hear about their important work. You can go online as well and find out more. KCRW.com/give. Do that today. And thank you. Coming up, all cash offers and properties listed for just a few days. California's housing market is crazy.
The home buyer explained it to me as thinking it was kind of like speed dating, but you're expected to get married at the end of this, right? And that's nerve-wracking for a lot of people, obviously.
That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. If you want to buy a house in California, well, good luck. The market hasn't been this hot in, well, who knows how long. The average house is on the market now for just 8 days. Homes often sell for over asking prices by more than $100,000 sometimes. Often all cash. The California Association of Realtors says the median home price is close to $760,000. And that's up 24% from a year ago. We're going to find out what's driving all this craziness now with Andrew Corey. He's been writing about this for the LA Times. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, $760,000, is that an all-time high?
Yes, I believe it is an all-time high, and home prices have just skyrocketed during the pandemic. There's just been an expansion of demand. People have been wanting more space. Mortgage rates are down to historic levels below 3%, which is unheard of. And at the same time, supply is down. There's not many homes for sale, and people are bidding prices up and purchasing homes in record time, and they'll fly off the shelf in days.
So what is it like? Let's say you do have the 20% down payment that you need now. Let's say you have a great credit report, you have a full-time job, you're making enough money to buy one of these expensive homes. What happens when you go out to buy a home? What does it look like?
So when you go out today, I mean, you have to be a little bit more prepared than you were maybe pre-pandemic. So you can't just show up to kind of an open house on the weekend and just stroll through it. You have to set up an appointment with an agent, you know, at the property to view it. You have to have a pre-approval letter, and you go through it, you know, one party at a time to maintain social distancing. And, you know, at houses that are in big demand, you might get there and there might be a line out the door. And so you're sitting in this line, you know, everyone else has their pre-approval letter, is ready to go. And you walk in, you do your tour, you come out, there's more people, they clean the house, the next person goes back in. And one person that was going through this, a home buyer, explained it to me as thinking it was kind of like speed dating, but you're expected to get married at the end of this, right? And that's nerve-wracking for a lot of people, obviously.
Right, because oftentimes this is the biggest thing they'll purchase in their lifetime. I mean, this is where they put all their savings, and this is where they look to grow their investment. It's their home.
Yep, this is the biggest investment that most of us will ever make in our life.
And so are people making offers right there on the spot? Like they tour the house in 15, 20 minutes and say, okay, I'm ready to make an offer?
Basically, yeah. I mean, they're deciding really rapidly to put in these offers, and homes are having just crazy number of offers. Talked to one agent that I think it was a house in Hawthorne had around 39 offers on it. And, you know, people are, when they're making the offers, they're waiving contingencies and they're trying to make their offers stand out. And, you know, it's extremely, extremely competitive out there.
So when you say waiving contingencies, they're saying, well, if something bad happens, turns up in the inspection, they're okay with it. They won't back out of the offer.
Correct. Yeah. So they're kind of putting themselves at risk there. You know, same thing if the appraisal doesn't come through, you know, they're putting some of their money at risk in terms of what they're putting up.
Well, who are these buyers? Because if there is such a shortage of homes, are these first-time buyers or people looking to buy another home, or who are they?
You're seeing an increase in both first-time buyers as well as repeat buyers that are buying either a second home and keeping their old one, or they're, you know, selling their old house and buying a new one. It's a little hard to tell, you know, which segment is sort of driving the market more, given some data issues, but you are seeing a lot of first-time buyers come to the market, people that, you know, might be cramped up in their, you know, apartments during this pandemic, and they finally decided, let's stop doing that and let's finally buy the house. And so a lot of analysts think that, you know, this has sped up a lot of, you know, purchases that would have occurred several years down the line, and people are just making the decision to buy now, particularly millennials who are kind of increasingly entering their early 30s, which is when a lot of people buy their home for the first time anyway. And before the pandemic, the housing market was heating up for that reason as well.
Right. And millennials, that's a big population bubble, right? The kids of the baby boomers. This is a rite of passage, right, for Americans in this age bracket to buy their first home, start a family, that kind of thing. It looks, though, with these housing prices, that that rite of passage is increasingly out of reach for many younger people.
Yeah, it's very difficult. I mean, for the median priced house, you'd have to make around probably a household income of maybe $130,000. And that's, you know, assuming that you have that 20% down payment. Falling mortgage rates have helped people afford a lot more in the last year and also allow them to bid up the prices of homes. And so that's, if you don't have that down payment, it's increasingly hard to actually get into the housing market. And so, you know, a lot of people that are getting in have family help and, you know, their parents were homeowners and they're able to pass down, you know, wealth to them and it perpetuates that cycle.
Right. What about property investors? Are you seeing that too?
You
are. Professional property buyers?
You're seeing those increase. The number of investors that are purchasing homes has risen in Southern California. And so that, you know, ranges from people that are buying a house to rent it out, buying a house to fix it up and flip it. But at the same time, you're actually seeing ever so slightly the share of investors decline. And so that's a reflection that there's just such an increase of demand from sort of the traditional home buyer that does want to actually live in the house.
And where are the hot markets in California? Where are people looking to buy the most?
Sure. I mean, across the state, really, but particularly where you've seen, you know, home prices kind of just skyrocket and been very, very competitive is in kind of these maybe like vacation markets where people might be buying a second home or relocating now that they can work from home, you know, might be relocating from the Bay Area to Tahoe. Palm Springs is extremely hot. San Diego prices are skyrocketing there as well. But, you know, here locally in Los Angeles and Riverside and San Bernardino, it's not like things are slow, that's for sure. You know, prices are skyrocketing and, you know, it's getting tougher out there.
I guess everyone's also wondering when this is going to end. Is the bubble going to burst? Any predictions on that?
You know, it's obviously hard to say. You talk to a different expert, you'll get a different opinion. You know, if you do look at sort of where the median home price now compared to a year ago and what the monthly mortgage payment on both would be, the monthly mortgage payment is not actually that much higher. It's increased a lot less than sort of the overall home prices. So, you know, I was talking with one expert the other day, said, you know, I don't think it can go up much more because of that. You know, there is a limit. Incomes will only allow so much. Lending is a lot tighter than during the early 2000s, which led to our bubble. But, you know, other people think we have a big run to go and it's likely to see double digit price increases, at least for the near future. So I guess we'll have to wait and see what happens.
Well, Andrew, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. That's Andrew Corey. He covers housing for the Los Angeles Times. Coming up, how the Kardashians infiltrated our culture. Their show may be ending, but their influence is not. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Tuesday, and that means one thing. It's time for TV on the radio.
The crown has landed on my head.
Yes, queen, yes.
You're not a killer.
This is the way.
You have to be a killer.
There was an offered before me.
If you're trying to curse, you can't.
That's bullshit.
We have so many disasters bombarding us right now.
Well, it is truly the end of an era in reality TV. Keeping Up with the Kardashians is ending after 14 years and 20 seasons. The show first became a massive hit when it debuted in 2007. And here's a clip of its star, Kim Kardashian, from the season 2 premiere.
Did you guys know that I'm like the number one Google search last week?
Oh my God, Kim, shut up. You're so into yourself.
And then yesterday I was the top AOL search for the whole week. Do you also know that you were the number 2 on the dumbest people from the New York Post? That's what they're...
As long as they're talking about me, honey.
Well, they are talking and we are talking and we're still talking about them. We're going to talk more about them now with Aaron Myers, author of the book Extraordinarily Ordinary, Us Weekly, and the Rise of Reality Television Celebrity. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you back. Well, that just seems like such a long time ago, hearing that clip. Even their voices are different. What, remind us, what was the show like when it debuted way back then in 2007?
When it first debuted, it was really fitting in with a lot of the other reality shows that were on at the time that focused on celebrities, which was to kind of go behind the scenes. I mean, they weren't really celebrities yet, but it was played as get a look behind the Hollywood lifestyle and kind of see them in their everyday normal sort of element. And it really played up, and I think continued to play up as it went on, that family element and the, really the family connections.
And it was a family that just kept giving. I mean, it seemed that they were completely willing to bear all, to show all, and we just couldn't stop watching. What was it? What is it about that that made this family so irresistible for so many years for so many people?
I think what you said about that they were just willing to give it all to us, that it was no holds barred, really, this sense that we were getting this complete naked truth, if you will, about the Kardashians and how they kind of worked, how they lived, how they played. And it just laid it all out for us in this sense that we felt really close to them, that we could develop an intimate connection with them because we could see so much of what their everyday lives were compared to the way that we saw traditional celebrities in a more guarded kind of way, you know, through magazine profiles or interviews with Oprah, things that were more official. The Kardashians were just, here's who we are, what we do every day, take it or leave it.
Well, plus mixed with the glamour and just the idea that you hear a bunch of rich people and we get to see how the rich live and we get to see them acting like normal people.
Absolutely. So it was always wrapped up in a sense of aspiration. So even though the show was a lot about here's their ordinary selves, at the same time, they were always glamorous. And as the show went on, it got more glamorous. I feel they really started to push that glamour to the forefront even more. I mean, they always lived in beautiful houses and wore designer clothes and had expensive lifestyles. But even the look of the show as it progressed got more stylized, got more, you know, slick. And compared to some of the other celebrity reality shows that were, you know, about tearing down those pedestals, this show was about taking their ordinary selves and putting that ordinariness on a pedestal through the constant appeal to glamour and lifestyle.
And selling it, too, and creating all these products that purport to give you that lifestyle. So they were really
savvy
business people, too.
Absolutely. That anything that they did, they knew how to package it and how to then brand it and sell it in other spaces. So they were really ahead of their time in terms of turning reality television stardom into something more. Turning, here's my everyday life, but this elevated, special, fancy, beautiful life that you can have if you, oh, buy these products that I happen to be selling to you.
Right. Or by getting some kind of cosmetic enhancement. And I'm wondering just what role their physical appearance, I mean, it's always touchy to talk about women's physical appearance, but in their case, I think that was also a main selling point, that we couldn't get enough of looking at them and how their bodies and faces transformed over the years. And also sort of selling that look to other women, to us.
And normalizing it, completely normalizing it, because you saw them get procedures on the show. It was just a normal thing that you did, whereas other celebrities try to hide that they've had work done. On this show, it was, here, we're going to go get fillers, or here's about the, you know, liposuction I want to get, or Kim, you know, later, but when she has her first baby, wanting to have her glam squad there to fix her up so that when her baby first saw her, she would be beautiful. As someone that has had a child, that was not at the top of my list of things to be concerned about, but they normalize this idea that every moment you need to be camera ready, and it's okay to do these kinds of procedures to get that way.
Yeah, so really their influence isn't just on television and our television viewing habits. Their influence is really in how we see ourselves, especially as women.
Absolutely. And celebrities have always played that role for us. They've always been markers of identity, whether aspirational or people who we don't want to be like. But I think what's unique about the Kardashians as forerunners of, you know, the reality television celebrity is the way that the ordinariness and glamour were wrapped up together. You also related to them because they were like you. They fought with their sisters. They had struggles with men. You know, they had strong relationships with their mother. You could relate to them, but then wrapped up in that, oh, they're just like me, is this idea that I can look like them because they're so relatable. So if it's possible for them, it must be possible for me.
Well, speaking of the mom, the matriarch of the family, Kris Jenner, and she's the mastermind behind all this, the momager, if you will, and oversees, well, she oversaw the creation of the show, but also apparently their business ventures. Here's a clip of her speaking at an event with the New York Times about the family's business savvy.
But there is something to be said about the way we started, the audience that we have now, and the people that follow us, and the consumers that buy our things are the people that became emotionally invested in the family.
How much of this had she thought of or planned out at the beginning? And I mean, you really have to just step back and admire from a business perspective what she's been able to do.
Absolutely. I mean, did she envision all of the girls becoming billionaires? It's hard to say, but she certainly had a plan that this reality show was a stepping stone, that this was just a way to get attention. And I think she was very savvy because reality TV, when this show started, was still pretty new, particularly for celebrities to come out of it. We looked at them as more sort of disposable. You know, you had the cast of Survivor, and then the next season it would be a whole new cast. But the Kardashians came into it and said, this is a way to get public exposure and exposure that we are going to control. And that was really important to shaping their image. And then, of course, they worked with the tabloids and you know, the gossip bloggers to give them good information and keep that image pretty consistent. But that was a real shift for seeing celebrity come out of these spaces instead of just another chance to see people on TV. And Kris Jenner really spun that into a whole empire.
Even though there have been no shortage of scandal with this family, and yet none have been brought down by the scandal, which is really extraordinary.
I agree, yes. I think that it's because they embraced the scandal and then worked to spin it in their own favor. Every single one of the sisters has had multiple scandals in different ways, but it's always become a way to say, hey, come see our side of the story of it. And so the show became the place to get the quote-unquote truth because it was coming directly from them. But, you know, if you think about some of the big scandals with Kim, even her micro marriage to Chris Humphries, the way that first played out as a big splashy wedding special, but then when the divorce happened 72 days later, then it was still, her story was told on the show. And so we could sympathize with her and then watch her recover from that and move on. And so all of these kinds of scandals are a way to get attention, but then they are very crafty at how they pull in that narrative back to their perspective as becoming the one that dominates the narrative for the media in general.
I guess I'm wondering how they're able to do that, why people haven't gotten sick of this and have turned on them, because people get sick of celebrities and turn on them all the time.
Yeah, that's a great question, because certainly they have their detractors, which isn't to say that everyone believes what they do and thinks what they do is great. But they manage to stay in the public eye, I think, maybe by balancing those critics with people that are attached to that intimate connection. Right. I'm not suggesting that people falsely believe that Kim Kardashian is their best friend, but there's a way that the show, and then now their social media platforms, I think, will really take on most of this work of making us feel like they're our friends and that we know who the real person is and we can connect to them. That even when something can come in as a scandal and disrupt that, or it seems like they're controlling the narrative too much, they just continue to bank on that intimacy.
Right. Even when it could be something as potentially disruptive to the family narrative as their father transitioning and becoming Caitlyn Jenner. And yeah. I just want to play a clip from her show, I Am Kate, where it's basically her learning more about the trans experience.
My girlfriend was like, come to my doctor. And I went in and the doctor said to her, oh, you're not bringing any more of those people in, are you?
Oh, oh, really?
In LA. Yeah.
Those people.
And I was like, wow, like it's still happening.
It's still,
you know,
still today.
You know,
really, that happened to you?
Yeah.
Yes, Kate, that happens all the time. A day in the life of being trans.
And here she is running for governor.
Yes.
I mean, it's extraordinary how this family has continued to survive and thrive and dominate the cultural conversation. Where do you expect them to go now?
I think it'll be fascinating to see where they go now. They've really been able to turn their social media platforms into the core of their celebrity and to play that role even more under their control than the show. The show always suffered from the problem of timing and television production, right? So when a tabloid would break a scandal or something major would happen, we'd have to wait to get the real story from them from the show. So I'm thinking, for instance, about Kim when she was attacked in Paris.
I have a family. I have my kids, like my husband, my mom. Like, I'm not going to make it out here. Like, I know how these things go.
That was like the last thought. And then they picked me up and put me in the bathroom and then ran.
Not that she, I think, was ready to come out and give interviews and do all that, but she held that back until the show. But that was months later. And they've done that with lots of things, right? So this idea that social media, they can react in a much more timely fashion and kind of control the stories or bring the stories back into a narrative that they find more appealing to their image. And I think that they'll just continue to grow those brands through their social media platforms.
They're getting older, as we all are. So I'm wondering, you teach pop culture. What do your young students think of them?
Yeah, some of them, you know, have only lived their lives with Kardashians. So they still, there's definitely still a strong fandom. I think we definitely see the younger Kylie and Kendall having more attention from some of the younger fans or younger students that I work with. They are really a foundational kind of celebrity for contemporary celebrity, the sort of Instagram influencer type social media star. They see the Kardashians as a major bedrock of that, even as it's, you know, proliferating and trickling down to different kinds of personalities as well.
Well, Erin, it's always great to talk with you. Thanks for coming on the show today.
Thank you.
Erin Myers is Associate Professor of Communication at Oakland University and author of the book Extraordinarily Ordinary, Us Weekly, and the Rise of Reality Television Celebrity. Well, it is KCRW's Drive to the Future, where your support goes beyond public radio. This is our spring membership drive, and it's day one of it. And, well, this drive has a greater purpose, and we are going to share that with you over the next coming days about how we're doing this a little bit differently. But suffice to say that your donation will go to other worthy organizations if you go now to kcrw.com/give. And we also have a challenge grant, $25,000. So your donation could turn $25,000 into $50,000. Thanks to the Hillenberg family. All you have to do is go to kcrw.com/give. And thank you. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.